All right, welcome to session 165, Millennial Mentality and Religious Relevance. So because this is a session on millennials, we do ask you to turn off your cell phones. If we can do it for 90 minutes, so can you. So unless you want to Facebook about how awesome this is, then.
You can have your cell phones on during mine.
Oh. Okay. Right, introductions. I'm Ellen Ducot. I'm a native from Antwerp, Belgium, and I moved to the United States in 1999. I just graduated from BYU with a degree in sociology, and I'm living the life of an unemployed graduate, undergraduate, so. Jennifer Duque was born in Woodland, California, and is completing a BA in English and Women's Studies at BYU. She recently acquired a gig with the BYU Political Review, a student-run newspaper, where she will be an associate editor and write a monthly column about gender-related issues. As a millennial and the daughter of my pioneer stock mother and convert father, she feels born into a sometimes contradictory heritage of doubting, cherishing, and seeking. She's glad to make this take this opportunity to discuss her plight of Mormon millennials. Anne Michelle Neal is in her second year as a graduate student studying school psychology at BYU. Born in the early years of the millennial generation, she finds herself in a complex position, balancing the parenting of three children and working towards a fulfilling professional career as a school psychologist. With a bachelor's degree in education from Central Washington University, she takes a lot of interest in the social and emotional issues facing young people and the interesting dynamic religiosity plays in the development of adolescents and young adults. And Chris Nagley hails from Alpine, Utah, and he studies economics and philosophy at BYU. And I apologize, I have a cold, so I'm going to sound like a caveman. I'm sorry. Okay, here we go. When one Googles the Church of Google, one will find an actual organization with that name. Devotees have congregated on an online forum and indulge in prayers such as, "Our Google, who art in internet, greatness be thy name, thy answers come when searches be done." The millennial generation, our generation, born between 1980 and the mid-1990s, is different from other generations in the sense that we grew up with the internet as a common household item. The internet is a metaphor for universality, information access, and connection, a hybrid of human, electronic, and technological aspects. Most importantly, an individual's presence on the internet is anonymous and democratic. Being connected with many people around the globe has taught us that the world is complex and that there is not one way of doing things. Even though there are still many battles to be fought, millennials grew up with the notion that certain types of equality are generally agreed upon, and many millennials have no problems with things such as interracial marriage and women in the workforce. In addition, with the rise of global corporate consumer culture, the world population is becoming more homogenous, and there is an increased profound sense of sameness among people around the globe. Lady Gaga's hit, and perhaps the millennial anthem, Baby, I Was Born This Way, is played in almost every major city in the world, and young people all around the globe seem to wear the same type of clothing. Interestingly, at the same time, people turn to the internet and look for specialized communities that fit their interests and needs, and where they feel deeply known and understood. As millennials come of age, many of them are leaving organizations where they should feel known and understood, namely faith communities they grew up in. The mass exodus from religion is not just a Mormon or a Christian phenomenon, but is also seen in Islam and Judaism. Even more, millennials are choosing the no religion option. At 26% of millennials not claiming a particular faith, they are the highest religiously unaffiliated compared to 20% of Generation X at that same age, and 13% of the baby boomers in the 1970s. While local wards may offer friendship, much of the doctrine in Mormonism does not offer the support millennials need. Commitment to the church is not fostered in adult Sunday school class, where lessons are one size fits all. While teachings about being a good follower of Christ do resonate with millennials, its teachings on how to be a good Mormon are difficult for millennials to swallow as a whole. Instructions about the number of piercings one can have, or what shirt to wear to church, or how gay marriage will destroy family, even though many places seem to be doing quite well after legalizing gay marriage, are irrelevant to a generation who grew up in the world of the internet. Rather than the church adapting to fit its members' needs and allow room for personal growth, Mormonism expects members to adapt to fit it. It seems that the church has lost much of its richness and appeal that convinced my parents to convert decades ago, and has been replaced by a giant, mass-produced corporation that can easily be replaced in the 21st century by something better. It may be easy to say that there's a difference between the doctrine of the church and the culture of the church, and conclude that it is possible to stay in the church while dismissing messages that do not apply to you. Yet many aspects that define Mormonism do become part of the gospel, and they also define how outsiders view us, even if we don't associate personally with said aspects. As we grow up, the church increasingly feels like another parent that has shaped us, but is also something we ultimately have to push away from and become our own grown-up person. That is not to say that millennials are always a me, you know, self-centered generation. Leading millennial researcher Neil Howe states that millennials will be known for their work on grassroots movements, teamwork, and civic spirit. We're doing it in the realms of community service, race, gender relations, politics, and faith. Millennials have a tremendous capacity to mobilize and volunteer for worthwhile causes, largely by using the internet. So millennials do not shy away from organizing and trying to make the world a better place. Though we are now able to organize on our own, but most importantly, we are able to organize on our own terms. Even if not every Mormon millennial checks out of the church, many who do choose to stay are marked by the culture at large. One such example of this is the increasing age of marriage around the country. And I need a drink. While Utah still ranks as a state with the highest number of married couples with children, the age of first marriage has increased as well. For example, many BYU students have marriage as a goal, but many students, especially women, are delaying marriage because they see the merits of finishing school first, being more mature, and perhaps they just want to enjoy their time being single. This trend has been addressed by many worried general authorities. In a 2005 CES Fireside, young women were urged to, quote, resist too much hanging out and, quote, don't make it easy for young men to hang out in a setting where you women provide the food. And this message was repeated in April when student wards were combined into young single adult wards. And again, the message was, stop hanging out and start dating with an eye towards marriage. The fact that this message has been repeated since the first millennials started college in 2000 and is still being repeated indicates that young Mormons see value in what their non-Mormon peers are doing and saying. Even if many young Mormons do find value in what the church has to offer, many of them are ignoring the instructions of the general authorities, and they do what they believe is best for them. With the combination of opportunities to travel, go to college, and high divorce rates, why would a young 20-year-old want to settle down? No matter what is being told from the pulpit, millennials will do what feels right for themselves, with little or no guilt about going against what the general authorities tell them. The world, which the church warns against over and over as being something evil and something we want to avoid, is currently offering more fulfilling options for young people. Moreover, for me and other millennials, the us versus them argument is a disconnected mentality, since there is little or no proof that our gay friends are out to destroy marriage, that other religions have no complete value, and that the atheist neighbor is actually a really nice lady. Perhaps there is no clear and defined answer or solution to make the church more appealing and keep young Mormons active. Perhaps the women president, Elaine Dalton, was right when she was asked during a 2008 press conference how to keep single Mormon women active, and she responded with, "That is a question of the day. I don't know that we have all the answers right now." There is no clear reason why large amounts of young people are leaving the church, and there is no solution how to keep young people in the church when competing with what the internet and the rest of the world has to offer. But it is clear that something within Mormonism is pushing young people out. And while this feeling of being pushed out is painful, young Mormons rely on the Church of Google to look for peers who understand them. In short, in the world of connectedness, one community can quickly be replaced with another.
Um, First of all, thank you all for coming to our panel. I think we all inwardly groaned when we saw the concurrent panels. And so anyway, thank you.
We're the future rock stars. We're just, you know, ready.
Yeah, we're the unknown rock stars right now. Okay.
You can all say you knew us when we were young 20-year-olds.
Before we were famous.
We can sign your program.
Okay. In the Mormon Matters podcast, the LDS Church and its single young adults, which could be retitled as Why This Generation of Mormons is Fleeing the Chapels, Joanna Brooks said, "We're a tradition of questioners. We're a tradition of seekers. You belong if you want to question, if you want to seek. But that's not a message they, i.e. the Mormon millennials, are getting a lot." Now, I want to briefly examine what it means or does not mean or has meant to adhere to the Mormon tradition, how our multiplicity of traditions have shaped my spiritual journey, not because my experience is particularly singular, but to hopefully add another dimension to the Mormon millennial phenomena. And I'm going to start with looking at the Book of Mormon, since old habits die hard. In the Book of Mormon, traditions harbor a dual nature. On the one hand, they represent the saving mindset and customs of Christianity. For example, Enos experiences spiritual rebirth because he acts on and yearns for traditions he learned from his father. Also, at the time, he and the people of Nephi are in the midst of a skirmish with the Lamanites, again in which the Lamanites swore in their wrath that, if it were possible, they would destroy our records and us, and also all the traditions of our fathers. Here, traditions are portrayed positively, worth preserving. Similarly, during the reign of Mosiah and Alma, a faction of the rising generation who were children during King Benjamin's General Conference addressed dwindle in unbelief because they, quote, did not believe in the traditions of their fathers, neither did they believe concerning the coming of Christ, close quote. Again, traditions are equated with righteousness. On the other hand, traditions also represent mindsets and customs that run contrary to the gospel. Alma 9:16, there are many promises which are extended to the Lamanites, but because of the traditions of their fathers, they remain in a state of ignorance. Alma 19:14, Ammon prays for the Lamanites, mourning over their iniquities and their traditions, etc. This good tradition slash bad tradition dichotomy, however, is simplistic. Despite their veneer of righteousness, for example, the Zoramites and their traditions are just as wicked and perverse as the Lamanites. They pray on an elevated place in the synagogue so everyone can hear them, and the invocations they offer on the Ramiyantum are mechanical and repetitive. So, to recap, in the Book of Mormon, traditions are varied and contradictory, good and bad. What's more, the most insidious of bad traditions masquerade as good traditions. Now, last year I attended a lecture by Terry Givens about early Mormonism. As you probably know, Mormonism is a syncretistically developed religion, meaning Joseph Smith assumed that the world was replete with scattered remains of the one true church. He essentially collected traditions he thought were cool, like Masonic temple rites and Muslim legends about Muhammad got the Quran, in order to form a Mormon tradition. True to the reformative spirit, he and his followers were constantly seeking and constantly questioning the theological status quo in order to chip away negative accretion and find a pure core, the pure core of religion. And I can identify with this tradition as an idealist and a questioner. It came naturally to find traditions of our mothers and fathers in Mormonism for me to be proud of and to identify with. When my parents and my mentors realized that I am an incorrigible feminist, they made sure to strew my path with woman-positive tidbits of Mormon history. And I ate them up and sought them out to dull the increasingly obvious, the church's unincorrigible patriarchy. For a while, I clung to this mantra, and some other feminists are familiar with this mantra sort of thing. Since Emmeline B. Wells was an advocate for women's rights, since Utah women were the first American women to vote, since Brigham Young told women to become physicians, that somehow should lessen the sting of, say, my seminary teacher telling me that women should stay at home, or certain passages from the Family Proclamation to the World, or the Young Women's Manuals in their entirety. So I cherry-picked which traditions I wanted to belong to and hoped the rejects would disappear. What was charming curiosity when I was young, however, became threatening when I got older. I was about 15 or 16 and in Sunday school, and we were having a lesson about the priesthood. We had a substitute that day who was a local politician, and he brought his wife with him. In a valiant, inevitable effort to make the girls feel more included in this lesson, he told us that men cannot attain exaltation and eventual godhood without a wife, because, of course, knowing you're crucial to a man's salvation imbues you with self-worth. I remember him pointing to his wife and saying, "Together we are Elohim." Well, this actually made sense to me because A, Elohim, as you know, can be the plural as well as singular word for God or gods in Hebrew, and B, as Eliza R. Snow wrote, In the heavens are parents single, know the thoughts makes reason stare. Truth is reason, truth eternal tells me I have a mother there. All excited, I raise my hand and ask the poor substitute if together we are Elohim, meant whenever Elohim was mentioned in scriptures or in prayers, we were referring to Heavenly Mother as well as Heavenly Father. I was excited because I wanted to know that Heavenly Mother was in my life, and I definitely felt that lack. To my surprise, this look of panic spread across the teacher's face, and he said, "No, Elohim, the scriptures refers to God and the Son. How dare I think otherwise? Praying to Heavenly Mother was a bad thing. Don't do it, and now let's open our scriptures." So the more I questioned, and the more I sought, and the more I investigated and adhered to, in my opinion, early Mormon traditions, the more my parents and teachers worried about me. And the more I experienced current Mormon traditions, the less comfort I found in past laurels. The beautiful tradition Joanna Brooks mentioned of questioning and seeking was negated by the tradition of correlated top-down male authority. And might I be so audacious to call this the foolish traditions of our fathers. But for years, I couldn't give up on my desire to radicalize the church. With Claudia Bushman, I believed that, quote, "someday the female priesthood will seem as commonplace as priesthood for black men today. The future of women in the church will gradually open itself to us. From my perspective, I think that we will have some positive and pleasant development," close quote. I wanted that development now. I soon had a new mantra. Maybe this general conference where women will speak. Maybe this general conference where women will speak in normal voices. Maybe this general conference a woman will pray. Maybe this general conference will talk explicitly about Heavenly Mother. Maybe this general conference the priesthood will be reinstated as gender neutral. And I told you I was idealistic. One day, while I was waiting for President Hinckley to finally have a revelation that would justify my membership, I stumbled across Women and Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. And as trite as this analogy might sound, I felt like I'd opened a treasure trove. I read that in the past, women's involvement in the priesthood was not limited to merely facilitating their husband's exaltation. Eliza R. Snow believed it to be the right and duty for women to perform healing ordinances. While some of the brethren do not approve of this, wrote Emmeline B. Wells, it is to be hoped the blessings will not be taken from us. Unfortunately, Brigham Young did just that. I read that the Relief Society used to operate independently until it was relegated to appendage status. I read about the Women's Exponent and the Relief Society magazine, publications for women, by women, that were eventually shut down, not for want of readership, but for want of male approval. I read poetry by Carolyn Pearson and others that expressed my own yearning for female deity, as well as personal discourse on God the Mother that frankly floored me, because it echoed exactly what I was thinking, and it was extremely affirming to know that other people thought the same way. And then I read, of course, that President Gordon B. Hinckley, in the year I was born, issued a gag order on my mother in heaven. And he was the guy who was supposed to have this revelation for me. Now back to the Mormon Matters podcast. Responding to Joanna's appeal to Mormon tradition, Jared Anderson, another of the panelists, mock seriously said something like, "but don't you know that once you're a member of the church, you're not allowed to ask questions?" He's right, but so is she. My generation of Mormons has inherited a gag order, yet we've inherited the urge to question and seek. I see it as consistent with the Mormon tradition of seeking and questioning to leave it. The status quo has become a dogmatic monolith, one that I don't feel comfortable or welcome in, and one that my Mormon foremothers would not feel comfortable in either. We've witnessed authority figures and peers alike remain in a state of ignorance because they refuse to question and seek. We've seen bad traditions, such as Prop 8, accentuated homophobia, masquerade as good ones. We've read about good traditions destroyed. Eliza R. Snow said in an address to the movement of the church, "Don't you see that our sphere is increasing? Our sphere of action will continually widen, and no woman in Zion need to mourn because her sphere is too narrow. If we support the current institution, her prophecy will never come to pass. Since the LDS Church shows little regard for traditional Mormonism, I suggest we increase our spheres beyond it. Thank you."
That was lovely. Thank you. My name's Anne Michelle Neal. I'm a millennial. I was born and raised in Utah County, but at age 19, I moved to Seattle, Washington, and then spent 5 years there and 4 years there and 4 years in Flagstaff, Arizona, another really quite liberal town where I came of age and both places have influenced my life very heavily, and lived as a liberal Mormon for a long time. I moved back to Utah 2 years ago to go to graduate school at BYU. I study school psychology, and have been in a state of cognitive dissonance since then. And there's something about Mormonism outside of Utah that feels autonomous. And here I feel that that is lacking for me anyway, personally. This is a topic of my generation, and our conflict and struggle with the church is sort of discussed widely among organizations like Sunstone, like Mormon Matters, and I'm going to refer to the same podcast that Ellen and Jennifer have both referred to as well. And my point of view comes from my experience as an educator, working with young people, also from my studies in psychology, thinking about the cognitive processes and behavior and how these things are influenced by religiosity and Mormonism. So in the Mormon Matters podcast, this was from May of this year, the title was Single Adults and the Church, if you want to look it up, it's the 31st, I think, podcast. There was a statement made that says there's a massive gulf between what my generation is taught from the pulpit and what we experience in real life. I think it's more than a discussion of do you believe or not? Do you believe, do you have faith in the principles of Mormonism, or are they good or useful? I think what we're experiencing is that these principles that we hear do not match our experiences in life. And how do we as humans reconcile this cognitively in our minds and in our hearts? The tendency, I think we all know, is for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to present things as black and white. Ellen mentioned the world as this evil entity, that we want to be in the world and not of it, that there needs to be this very clear divide between ourselves and the world. But the reality is that we know man as an island. We live in this context of culture and reality, and what we are experiencing is very different from what we're told to avoid, I guess. Things are painted as scary and frightening, and in reality, they're not that scary, and it causes some cognitive conflict for my generation. I think it was Jared Anderson. He said that this conflict causes people to make a choice. They either have to believe fully, as in the Book of Mormon musical song, you have to believe it all, or you can't believe any of it at all. There's no place in the middle for picking and choosing, for adhering to some doctrines and not others. The church wants full compliance, and it does put young people in a difficult position. Like I said, I'm studying psychology. I'm fascinated by cognitive processes, by how people reconcile things, and the mental gymnastics that must take place for us to hear one thing and see something else. I might touch on this example in a couple of different places because I find it pretty important, but my best friend from high school is gay, and he's a wonderful, happy, loving person. I love him, and what I hear from my general authorities is that he's attacking the institution of marriage, that he's an abomination before God, and I don't believe that. Young people... people younger than me are coming out as early in high school, and their peers around them see that their gay friends are not threatening, are not scary, and so when they hear from the pulpit that that these things are terrible and abominable, they kind of disagree. They kind of say, "Hey, Jeff's a good person." This causes, I think, a conflict mentally, and people have to do some compartmentalization to cope with that conflict that's happening cognitively. Like I said, there's a distinct gap by what we're told by the church and what people experience in their life. Part of this has to do with the access to information that we have, an unprecedented access to information. I thought of, while Ellen was speaking, the book The World is Flat, which talks about business and how the playing field for business has been very leveled because of technology and the internet. But I think it's also true socially and emotionally. We are no longer limited to our small communities to influence us and teach us about the world. We are now have input from all over the world to teach us about what is socially acceptable, what is socially normal. I think of not just the internet, but even the development of reality TV as a way of presenting alternative lifestyles. Reality TV is probably not the best example because it's sort of extreme, but young people see a great more diversity of lifestyles than previous generations. I think there are a lot of things that the LDS approach doesn't compute with reality, one being marriage. There are a lot of reasons to delay marriage, a lot of good reasons, but even in the last general conference we heard from President Monson that young people need to get married, do not delay marriage, and he emphasized, even if it's not, don't wait for the right perfect person, it'll work out. You can make it work. A temple marriage will work, we promise. And that's not reality. And there are a lot of really good reasons to delay marriage, financial, educational goals, career goals, or maybe even people who want to choose not to get married or not to have children. Those things don't have to be bad things. An interesting psychology fact is that the frontal lobe doesn't develop fully until we're 25 years old, and by that time many LDS individuals have several children, a career, and have mortgages by the time they're 25, and this is far, I think, my opinion is that you need to wait for your brain to develop before you start making those kinds of decisions. I think that I already gave the example about my friend who's gay. But I think there are other examples of lifestyle options that that young people see around them that don't align with the traditional Mormon pathway of serve a mission, get married at 22, have children by 23. Like I said, young people are seeing around them other young adults who are very, very happy and in pathways like delaying marriage, in pathways such as being gay or being a Democrat, or I think that life provides so many more mental models for life than the church provides. The church has sort of one pathway, and our generation seeks out lots and lots of variety and different things, and I think that's one of the things that the church is not offering young people, and one of the reasons why people of my generation are leaving. This idea of mental models is something I've been thinking of for a while. My sister said it to me in a conversation we had, that the church presents things as black and white, and there is no mental model for things such as responsible alcohol use or even responsible pornography use, that these things don't have to lead to absolute... What's the word I'm thinking of? These things don't have to lead to
destruction
of your life. That there are people who are very happy who live outside of the Mormon mainstream or outside of the Mormon lifestyle, and that it doesn't mean that they are unhappy or miserable. And I think young people are seeing that. It's exposure to their peers and from technology that we are starting to see that Mormonism isn't the only way of life, and I think if the church wants to retain young people, they have to acknowledge this reality that there is a gap between what we are told and what we experience. As a teacher, I know that hands-on experience is the most powerful teacher, that people learn best through
through real-world, real-life experiences. And this is what is becoming the most powerful impact on my generation. Their experiences are teaching them much more than maybe what was experienced in previous generations. I think of the small town where I grew up. I grew up in Spanish Fork, and my parents grew up there, and what they were exposed to in this very small community then was very limited compared to what my children would experience if they were growing up there now. And the world is flat in some ways, and the influences come from everywhere, and they're not all negative, and they're not all terrible and destructive. And I think that it's an important question that to be examined when considering this problem that the church has of retaining young adults.
All right. Well, I'm actually the vice president of the Democrats at Democrats Club at BYU, but I might start sounding a little bit conservative here, so prepare for a fantastic transformation. So I thought I'd, if you could give me 5 minutes and go on there, that'd be great. I'll start with some demographic information about how LDS youth relate to the average American youth. I didn't go beyond the United States in my scope, mainly because there's not a lot of good demographic information, and to make any sort of general statements internationally would be foolish. I'm pretty sure that the cultures of different countries bear heavily on these sort of dynamics. Then I'll relate some of my personal story to sort of give you an idea of my particular biases, so you can make any alterations in how much salt you take with whatever I say. And then I might say a little bit of I might comment on some of the things the other panelists have said. I hope that isn't against the rules. Hopefully not.
They're nice comments.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. So, okay, first of all, I should say that demographic information on LDS youth is scarce. It is very, the statistics have very low numbers of participants. I mean, you're getting studies with about 200 people. In the case of sort of a recent seminal book on religious demography, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us by Robert D. Putnam and David E. Campbell, the number of Mormons surveyed in their very wide and also very deep survey were only 50, because they had to keep the proportion of members equal to the proportion in the United States. So trying to make any sort of statistical argument from 50 people, if you take any basic statistics, is not very valid. So I'll give you a brief overview of what we have, and then I'll sort of venture into the realm of anecdote and speculation, which is always more fun anyway. So first I'll start with sort of the state of young people in religious life here in America. Christian Smith and Patricia Snell, they're with Notre Dame right now, published in 2009 a book called Souls in Transition, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of Emerging Adults. And they didn't really go out to find any sort of general patterns or some sort of unified theory of the relationship between young people and religion. But what they found was an interesting phenomena, a sort of a theological construct that they called moralistic therapeutic deism, which perhaps some of you have heard of. It's comprised by five basic claims about the universe and not much else. So I'll read those off to you. This is what most young people between 18 and 30 believe. This is their creed. One, a God exists who created and ordered the world and watches over human life on earth. So a pretty basic theistic claim. Two, God wants us to be good, nice, and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and in most world religions. Doesn't really matter which religion you hold. That's an important point. Three, the central goal of life is to be happy and feel good about oneself. Four, God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life, except when God is needed to resolve a problem. So maybe I can't find my car keys, something like that. Five, good people go to heaven when they die. Not too much thought on where the bad people go. You know, that's not as therapeutic. You know. Interestingly, almost everyone surveyed thought that they were one of these good people, of course. So there are a number of interesting consequences for this. As the earlier panelists referenced, we get a lot of religious migration, a lot of people leaving traditional churches and sort of moving in between the sort of vague commercial Christianity that one can see in certain non-denominational churches. And they actually, Smith and Snell note that there's actually a lot of diversity within this group, even though they're highly mobile and moving between different religious bodies. That roughly breaks down into six categories within the sort of general moralistic therapeutic deism. First are committed traditionalists. So about 15% of youth are highly committed to their religious practice. They're devoted, and they primarily view the world through the prism of their original religion or converted religion. But that's a significant, that's a deep minority. And the next largest religious group is about 30%, which are selective adherents. So they take it or leave it. If it matches their own personal philosophy, if it accords with their experience, then they'll accept their religion. If it doesn't, then that's, you know, so much the worse for the religion. The spiritually open, which are uncommitted to any sort of religion, but are open to spiritual ideas, so they typically tend to be open to New Age ideas. You know, maybe Oprah comprises, you know, their weekly religious experience, is about 15%, whereas 25% are religiously indifferent, so actively don't care about religion. That's a core component of their philosophy. 5% are religiously disconnected, and 10% are antagonistic, so they actively work against religious causes. So the reason I listed all of that off is somewhat tedious, I apologize, but is that you see a surprising correlation in LDS youth in the study to this therapeutic moralistic theism or deism. It basically breaks down into similar groups with a slight skew upward on the number of traditionalists and the number of people who mix and match. So, but interestingly, a lot want to keep on self-identifying as LDS. So 72% of people surveyed identified as being LDS later. 59% said their faith was very important to them. This is LDS youth. And only 60% go to church, according to the study, which is probably a little bit larger than some of the other claims that we've been hearing recently, at least that I've been hearing. And 54% practice personal prayer, 71% Sabbath observance. Anyway, it's a lot of statistics. So the point is that LDS youth typically mirror the wider society in the degree of their religious commitment and a lot of the theological claims that they're willing to accept. And the specific theologies adapted by youth, sort of the adaptation of Mormonism, typically emphasize some of the more liberal elements, sort of emphasize the universalism of Mormonism, you know, possibly even augmenting the doctrine of kingdoms with progression between kingdoms. Sort of little tweaks like that are common. And finally, many of these results are recapitulated in American Grace. Specifically, they theorize that the increasing liberal political attitudes of young people are disaffecting a lot of the youth from the church, which, I mean, here at Sunstone, not really that much of a surprise to any of us here, probably. So that's basically the American situation and the relation of LDS youth to it. So now I'm going to venture into some more anecdotal evidence. So I've interviewed a lot of young people personally, and I've noticed a few patterns. I haven't, you know, passed out surveys or anything, but so take it as you will. But I've noticed that there's a significant class or income, you know, I'll say class is sort of an amalgam of educational opportunities, predicted income, and situations like that. There's a definite correlation in my experience between people who could be seen as being lower class or, you know, lower educational opportunities and lower income opportunities and inactivity in the church. So because lifestyle choices like smoking, alcohol use, any number of things like that are more highly correlated with lower incomes typically,
It could be just a consequence of the relative costs and benefits of engaging in those activities for people in different demographic brackets. But there does seem to be a class connection. I mean, theologically, Mormonism would seem to appeal more to a middle-class, stable nuclear family. So that's a theory. When I interviewed people, sin did, kind of the traditional narrative of either sin or laziness did come into the picture. And surprisingly, a lot of young people who were inactive were willing to self-identify in the two sort of classic institutional models for disaffection. They were willing to say, well, I sinned and I've lost my way. One day I'll get back when I want to live a different lifestyle. Or, I don't know, I just don't really think about it. It doesn't seem that important, but I still basically believe everything. So I found that interesting. People were willing to sort of claim Mormonism, but in a narrative that sort of disparaged them. So I found that fascinating. I wouldn't have predicted that at all. So basically, why do we see these movements away? Well, I do blame this idea, this sort of vague, fluffy, moralistic theism. I mean, it discounts and discredits a lot of the peculiar doctrines of Mormonism. It rejects the idea of any one true church. It rejects the idea of even proselyting, because the point of a religion is for it to work for you. It's a product in a marketplace that you go and acquire and adapt it to your life. And that sort of model isn't the wouldn't really benefit the sort of deeply communal, cultural experience that one would normally have in Mormonism. You are inducted into a specific jargon, a specific way of life, and I don't think that that's readily compatible with the sort of hyper-individualistic, consumer-ready religious marketplace that exists today. So that's sort of an overview of kind of the scholarship, and the last bit was the anecdotal evidence, so don't confuse that. But here's my personal story. I basically, in high school, I was inclined to philosophy. I read a lot of religious books, kind of a nerd. And I sort of began to absorb, and I think this is common in a lot of people, a sort of zeitgeist, a feeling of modernity when you sort of read. You read, Albert Camus, you read Dostoevsky, and you feel like theism or this, traditional religious narratives are under attack, and popular culture doesn't value it that much. So it's a foregone conclusion that, disbelief or, things like that are either trendy or possibly an appropriate response to kind of the zeitgeist. So a lot of these, the values that motivate, for instance, this therapeutic deism, and I think youth in general tend to be, nebulously defined general life values or approaches to life. So I got some of that. I definitely absorbed a lot of the moralistic therapeutic deism of the day. And anyway, I went on my mission as sort of a gamble with God, because I didn't have this absolute knowledge. So it was sort of a strange Abrahamic sacrifice. And on my mission, I think I went to Lynchburg. And if anybody knows what Lynchburg is like, it's a mixing pot of all different sorts of extremely conservative Christianity, generally fundamentalist, often. So there's diversity, but all that diversity is contained within the realm of extremely politically active, extremely conservative Christianity. And there are like 1.5 million seminaries in the town. So I got into a lot of religious arguments. They train pastors there specifically in Mormon countercult ministries. So they're extremely aggressive. They're extremely confident, and I was able to interact with a lot of their ideas because they sort of use a basic sort of Christian theological apologetic. So I was able to interface with a lot of those ideas. And initially I rejected them as being just, anti-Mormon. So this is a cultural attack upon my people. And so I responded by, defending my family. So why are you attacking my people? They're good people. They don't secretly worship Satan, You're horribly mistaken. Anyway, after my stay in Lynchburg for about 6 months, arguing with a load of Baptist pastors and sort of spitting at them the popular Mormon response to Protestant Christianity, which is, well, all your pastors are just in it for the money. This is all priestcraft. Look at you and your big, you know, mansion down the street. So it wasn't extremely reflective, I admit. And so later on in my mission, I discovered that a lot of these anti-Mormon claims, you know, had a relationship to the actual history, you know. So there were things called seer stones, and they were used, and the polygamy situation was a little bit, you know, had a lot of warts, as they say. And so I just started ordering books over and over again, to the point where 4 months later, in this little backwards West Virginia town, I was in my missionary apartment with just history books and Mormon theology books from like Blake Osler and stuff strewn around me, and I realized I had just deconstructed everything, you know, and I was totally alone. So I didn't tell my parents about it, I didn't tell my companions about it, I didn't tell my mission president about much except saying, hey, can I get this book? And they all have, you know, kind of scholarly or innocuous sounding names. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, well, I can't believe no one realized this before. I must be the only one. You know, I've never met anyone who thinks like me. So, and so I wound up coming back from my mission, only to discover, in a blaze of glory, just totally destroyed tons of relationships. Told my parents, you know, this is all not true. Why didn't you know this? You probably kind of, didn't do your due diligence here. I mean, we're in a religion that's like demonstrably wrong, you know. So that's sort of how I came home. Not a good situation. I don't recommend it. So anyway, long story short, I discovered that actually these sort of conversations have been happening pretty much since the beginning of time, you know. And I'm not that special or amazing or insightful or anything like that, you know. I'm a guy that found some books. Great. So, so basically the journey from there has been realizing, like, there's a deep history here. And, you know, if you reject your community offhand because you found some problems, you know, because you swallowed this narrative that everything had to be perfect, that everything was, you know, that the institutions of religion, you know, don't have any complications. It's the pure truth. You know, they can do no wrong. This is all pretty cliche. But so basically, long story short, family relationships repaired, luckily. Probably very unlikely, but it happened for me. And I'm at BYU now. Had to talk to Bruce Hafen. They wouldn't let me back in the school without a, you know, signed letter from a general authority. So that was neat. So there's my bias, okay? So I've been around this argument. I've talked to a lot of people who are disaffected. I've been, you know, pretty critical in the past. Now I just see it as, you know, it's a social system. It's an institution. It exists to, you know, it has its goals, but also exists to perpetuate itself. So I've sort of arrived at a place of sort of quietism, or you might even say satisfaction with the whole thing. I feel like I have a good place for myself. So I guess that leads into sort of my thoughts on a lot of these issues. Like, the other panelists are right. Like, there are things that just really chafe about the institutional church. Like, they don't feel right. They don't accord to our values that we use in all other situations. So you go out into an institution, you see women in hierarchical situations. If you went into an institution and there were no women except secretaries, you know, right now we parody institutions like that on, you know, HBO with Mad Men. You know, it's just something like totally alien and strange. So we expect the church to recapitulate the values that we value in society. And in a lot of ways it should. I mean, that's a tough issue. But There's another sense where, and I don't necessarily buy into kind of the Mormon 2.0 open Mormon movement where, your affiliation with Mormonism can be completely unrelated to any sort of theological or doctrinal statement you can make. So you can be a full-on atheist and have your atheist blog, but still call yourself like an institutional Mormon and go to church. Like that could be... Oh, yeah. So I feel like, to wrap up, I may have been rambling, I apologize. But there's something important about coming to terms with your history, of owning it, of somehow reconciling yourself to that. And I, voicing the problems in the church is definitely one way of doing that. It's a time-honored way of doing that. But there's a sense in which, culturally and historically, you can look over sort of the decades behind you, the cultural critics, were invariably marginalized and pushed to the side, and people like, I think it was McConkie who said that, it just relegates them as yapping dogs that follow the plodding trail of the great pioneers who move off into the glorious future, So there's something to be said for maybe disengaging yourself in a way to where the institutional problems of the church, the sort of cultural norms, can be viewed anthropologically the same way that, say, you'd go to a Zulu tribe in Africa and the strange mating practices and the patriarchy there, while you would say isn't optimal, would be seen as something sort of odd or distant or kind of quirky. At least that's worked for me. But anyway, that's kind of my response. It's more practical than philosophical, I suppose. And I guess we'll move to questions. Thanks.
Shoot away. Go for it, Brock.
I'll just go. To me, I'm not really in the church anymore. So I mean, just to let you know where I'm coming from, really. I feel like thinking about it a lot. I mean, because we're all thinking about these things and trying to reconcile these things. To me, it's kind of this choice. If I was the church, I guess, do I alter the church, I guess, drastically over time to retain these members, I guess, our generation or whatever? Or will I retain more members and more maybe control or obedience by keeping the church at the status quo,
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that it's even a totally static, solid thing to begin with. So to me, that's kind of the balance. One of the things that I wanted to ask you guys was just kind of how you identify, though, like spiritually or religiously, or if you do at all, just the panel, if you care to share that. You don't have to, of course. But.
Sure. I went to BYU and had my testimony crushed at BYU because of combination of things, religion classes that were very extreme, that kind of sense of more like things we would learn in classes kind of almost being downplayed. I had this Mormon kind of, we have all the answers. Right now, I am kind of an agnostic, no religion type of person. I don't attend Mormon church. I still identify, culturally, sort of, because, my parents are converts, so I have that connection. I have an interest in it, that's why I'm at Sunstone. But I'm just kind of agnostic, and I try to be a good person for the sake of being a good person, so that's kind of where I am. You're all at BYU, so...
Oh, yeah, you
don't
I don't care.
Google.
So,
I'll turn off the recorder.
I go and talk to professors all the time. There's no question of how I feel about things. It's sort of a mixed bag. As far as definite theological statements, sort of a philosophical statement. So is it true or false? Pee or not pee? I would say that I generally argue that true religious knowledge of the sort that compares to, say, scientific knowledge or anything like that, and this might sound kind of obvious, but religious knowledge is pretty impossible as far as the depth of knowledge that we can have about most other things, say, the presence of this audience here. So, and that because of that, any sort of particular religious claim, say, a
Muslim proclaiming the specific superiority of the Quran. Say it's it was dictated by this country bumpkin, camel herder, right? Not actually a camel herder, but that might be the stereotype. He couldn't read, and he produces this work of fantastic literature, and how could that not be from God? Well, I'll take your Quran and I'll raise you the Book of Mormon, right? So all of these sort of epistemic arguments, these ways of arriving at truth that for different religions I see the exact same form of the claim used for diametrically opposed things. You can't use an argument to prove two contradictory positions, so logically it can't really be a good argument. So that's kind of how I approach it, kind of an aggressive agnosticism, but practically, sort of from a practical standpoint, whatever religious community you decide to join for your own idiosyncratic reasons, and I guess this shows how I've absorbed this moralistic therapeutic deism, right? If it helps you, great. So I don't have any problem with religion. I go to church every week.
Do you two want to... I'll get you, but do you want to...
Google? No, just kidding. I don't know. I'm definitely still on a spiritual journey to answer your question, but I will say that I definitely feel a lot closer to Mormon. I feel more like a Mormon when I read a piece by Janice Allred, say, than when I read the Book of Mormon. And so there's a kinship, definitely, but not in the traditional sense.
I identify as a liberal and cultural Mormon. I think Mormonism is something you sort of can't escape.
Very true.
You can take the Mormon out of the church, but you can't really take the church out of the Mormon. Mm-hmm.
I like that. we talked, other people talked as well as why can't we identify as cultural Mormons? Jewish people identify as cultural
Jews. Orthodox.
Yeah, yeah,
and
Orthodox secular Jews.
It's a heritage, you can't escape it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just throw in a Holocaust and then we could probably do it. Honestly, it would probably take something deeply...
They still identified as Jews, though.
I think your statement was really pertinent that what do you do? Do you try to change the church, this massive organization, and you're one person beating on the wall? Mm-hmm. Or do you change yourself to conform, and what does that mean for you? I think it's an important question.
Mm-hmm. Kim, we'll get you first.
I have a bunch of questions. I don't really know where to start, but
I'm
curious how you would partner.
Oh, I said question number one's great. It's a good place to start.
Start with question number one.
I'm curious whether you would resonate with one thing. People were describing one of the disconnects is the exposure to a lot of ways of being rather than one prescribed way. One other thing that I thought is particularly true of your generation is a sense of self-definition, of self, choosing your own description, self-publication,
mm-hmm.
Finding your own community and creating it yourself, a whole lot of sort of bottom-up creation of the world where the institution is so incredibly top-down. I see you nodding your heads. I was curious whether that resonated with you and with your peers, if you think of them, to what extent... is that a significant clash emotionally with the church?
I think, can I just respond?
Go for it, yeah.
In this Mormon Matters podcast that we've been talking about, Jared Anderson said, if the church isn't meeting our needs, we're going to create a Facebook group
mm-hmm.
that does meet our needs. We have this immediacy and this ability to network that is unprecedented. And so we can sort of create what we need, and that changes our approach to the religion.
So one of the ways that works in the world is that democracies survive better than dictatorships because they have these escape valves for creating, and I'm curious, just from what you said, whether forming your own Facebook group helps people stay in the church because they've got a new community of people who are still in the church, or moves you further away because within that place you're powerful and in the church mm-hmm. you're not.
I think it probably goes both ways, I'd say. Because one thing about this radical sort of decentralization of social networks and communication that the internet brings, is that if the church isn't meeting my needs in one particular way, then I can find something. If it's a forum, if it's a, you know, some sort of book or a social group, that will make up for that need. And I guess what would determine whether someone keeps on going to church or not is that if the church continues to bring something to the table for that particular person. So, I mean, demographically, we see about 60% of people stay, and I imagine a lot of that has to do with sort of cultural inertia. Mm-hmm. I mean, your family's important, and as far as the cost, the church isn't too expensive if you still get to talk to your parents and, you know, keep on going to the family reunions. So, yeah, both ways, I'd say. A lot of it depends on the individual.
And I'd say also, like, you know, when we do make a Facebook group, I mean, like, even, like, Feminist Mormon Housewives, like, all these blogs that we found, like, I remember when I was going through my crisis of faith, I was like, oh my gosh, Feminist Mormon Housewives, it's so great. But you do create that sort of, you know, you kind of isolate yourself from the culture at large. Like, after a bad day at church, I go read FMH and I feel great. But, like, I can bring that great feeling I get, you know, from talking to other people, from being on my own Facebook group, into the church. And after all, at least for me, that cognitive dissonance was just so great and so unbearable, because I felt like I was living two different types of Mormonism almost. And so it goes both ways, where Facebook groups are helpful, but if it's something like Mormonism that is so lived and so valuable in your life and so integrated, like, it is more difficult to kind of, you know, what am I trying to say? Like, find that alternative community for such a, like, a prominent lifestyle, you know, it's, yeah. We'll just kind of go across the room, so yeah, in the black shirt.
The term millennium to your generation, where does that come from exactly? Is it from the book Generations, it talks about the cycles of history, or is it a different
Isn't there
term?
A devotional?
The term was coined by Neil Howe, he's a professor at BYU. I think in the realm of athletics or health. But he has a book. Do you remember the title?
I think it's called... what did you say it was called? He has a book.
But the researcher is Neil Howe.
And Howe is with an E, so...
Yeah, it's become fairly popular amongst demographers. You know, you got to have a name. It's going to be Generation X or... Baby Boomers, the Greatest Generation, or something.
Mm-hmm. We've also got, like, Net Generation or Generation Y, mm-hmm. But Millennial is, like, the most... It's a cool-sounding word, so... Yeah.
So I guess my question is for the panelists who go to BYU, how many of the student body really research the history of the church, the narrative? Do they just accept it at face value, or are they trying to dig a little bit deeper because of what critics are saying about the church in this era of internet where you can get so much information? Are they trying to drill down to... more than just what's being taught on the surface?
Yeah, I think that's something that we did want to address but didn't. In the podcast, it gave you the impression that all millennials saw it the way, basically the way we think, you know, we have our gay friends, blah, blah, blah. The reality is we're in the minority, though. At least that's what it feels like at BYU.
At BYU, it definitely feels like the greater population is focused on conforming and adhering to the principles and getting married. Before I went to BYU, I called it the Mormon...
So that's why changing the church to me seems so unlikely, because the people in authority are going to be the people that are extremely faithful, and it'll just be a perpetuating cycle, and they'll have children and blah blah blah. So
there's a culture there that's hard to describe. Mm-hmm. There's a status symbol associated with faithfulness and adherence.
I can hardly fault the students for, you know, trading. Well, they get real benefits from their strategies they're using in their life.
Physical benefits.
Yeah. So how can I can't really blame them.
They're rewarded, definitely.
It's real. So, but as far as people studying the history, like, I don't see a lot of students down there, down in the library, in the church history section with D. Michael Quinn. You know, like, I've gone there every couple of months, and it looks like the shelf hasn't, you know, been touched. There's like dust, a little bit on top. Not to say anything bad about the librarians at BYU, they're great. But
go ahead.
Well, the interesting thing is that the religious education department does a pretty good job of kind of alluding to historical problems without really fully illuminating them, you know? So it's kind of a halfway step to inoculation. So you're aware that the problems exist, and you're aware that somebody who's way, way smart and really spiritual and really great knows about the problems and doesn't bother them at all. So why should it bother you? I mean, you have your life to live, and, you know, that sports car or whatever you're trying to get, that wife isn't going to marry you all by yourself, so...
And I also think generally, like, church history is kind of, you know, it's history. It's not that super, I mean, it is to us, but the average person, our age, is not going to, like, study Mormon history for 5 hours for fun, you know, like, we're fascinated by it. So I think it's just, you know, an interest. And I mean, it could happen, like, they study Mormon history, and like Chris said, like, they're not, you know, maybe they won't find any problems with it. And, you know, like, church history does not always equal crisis of faith. Or, well, maybe it does. I don't know, but...
I think there's a tacit stigma against church history, though, amongst a lot of TBMs. Like, if they see you reading a church history book, like, even just, like, a Bushman book, they'll be like, well, are you, you know, still going to church and stuff? So there's a stigma still.
So, yeah, they're pretty aware of the problems. But I wanted to add one thing. There are actually different tracks in the religious education classes. So you can take, say, and this name probably won't mean anything, but Brother Bob. Randy Bott. So he's this sort of older guy, really, really theologically conservative, like outrageously theologically conservative.
Crazy.
So like McConkie and Joseph Fielding Smith are like lightweights compared to this guy. And so you can do that. I actually took his religious preparation class, so that was a
food.
Mission prep, yeah. And,
you're going to be rebaptized.
And but there's also other routes, like you can take the who's the female church historian that
Susan
Easton Black. So she takes the route of just deluging you with information, just so many dates, so many, you know, little minuscule facts in the chronology of the founding of the church, that any of the significance of the historical events will be totally drowned by your attempts to actually pass her history exams. So that's one apologetic technique. It's actually, it's pretty intelligent. Usually teachers that say delve into biblical criticism during your religion class, they don't stay very long. I had one, he was gone next semester, so that was cool.
Right. You in the stripy shirt, you had your hand up for a long time.
Yes, I've been really informative listening to you. I'm a father of three children, mm-hmm. into your age group. My question, anybody can respond to it, is do you think that in your generation that the way that you understand and relate to authority is different than previous generations? And if so, in what way do you think your different understanding of authority plays into your attitudes, mm-hmm. in regards to religion or other aspects of your lives?
That's interesting, because I read, you know, doing my research, I read that millennials, I didn't put it in the paper, but that millennials are actually, they actually kind of like authority, because in a way, like, our lives growing up are so highly structured, and I'm sure you did this with your own children, you know, like, driving to French lessons and Tai Chi lessons, and you had them on this kind of schedule, and we're kind of raised in this system where if we do what we're supposed to, we'll be rewarded. There's always kind of that reward kind of structure. So this is what the research says. I'm not sure if this is for everyone, but like we do depend on authority, because we've never really been, you know, there's always kind of a reward that we will get. But then, you know, like Jennifer was saying, you know, you want to take it from here, or do you know what I'm
talking about? I don't know what you're talking
about.
Okay. But I do have something to say.
Okay. But like, you know, like we have these hopes that authority, like authority figures will kind of, in a way, cater to our needs, in a way, or, you know,
answer to our needs.
Yeah, and will understand us and have our best interests at heart. And this is, I mean, in general, I'm not talking about, like, people who've been abused, like, I'm not, you know. But we do, and so it's, when we do encounter kind of that betrayal by, you know, religious authorities, it is heartbreaking. It is very, very heartbreaking, and I think that actually is a huge maybe a reason that needs to be more explored for Mormon millennials is that just that heartbreak that you get from your leaders. And also, you know, with Prop 8, you know, like, we had, you know, leaders going against, you know, our gay friends, you know, it's just sort of like, but why are you doing this, you know, why, so, I don't know if that helped your question.
So kind of a disillusionment with authority kind of thing going on. And also, okay, there was a recent CES at Fireside, was it Russell Ballard that gave the talk? Does anyone know? Because I don't. Anyway, it was some guy. That sounds really disrespectful, I'm sorry.
I think that answers the question.
No, there's one to say. And, like, he tried to appeal to the Mormon millennials' ego kind of thing, like, stick with us, kid, and we'll promote you kind of thing. Like, I see you as our... Yeah.
Elder Ballard.
Yeah, Elder Ballard. I was right. And, yeah, so, like, saying, I see you as our future leaders, our future priesthood officiators or whatever. And they actually talked about this in the podcast, how that incentive doesn't work now because we are a little anti-corporate, and this idea of stick with us, kid, and you'll be promoted isn't as appealing as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of different within what Ellen was saying, but...
No, it's a weird combination. I also think that, like, especially in, you know, like, the 60s and the 70s, there was this huge, huge uprising against authority, and so we are, in a way... We sort of embrace that. Like, that's also normal for us to, like, you know, question authority. It still is kind of an anthem or a prevalent phrase for our generation as well. But at the same time, we've also, you know, learned to trust authority because we kind of, I guess, figure out the reward system kind of thing. So.
Well, and in the academic field, we're always taught to check your sources. You can't check Wikipedia. So I don't know. That might feed also somewhat to your question about authority.
Right.
Always questioning sources.
I have one last thought that having studied child development and parenting styles and attachment theory, we were raised by parents who were very nurturing and loving versus baby boomers who were raised by very cold, unaffectionate parents. And we're sort of pointed at as having too much self-esteem, like there was too much emphasis on, oh, don't hurt their self-esteem when we were little. But as a result, we grow up and we're able to speak to adults as peers and have dialogue in that way. And so I think we do engage differently with authority, and position of authority may not be what we want. You know, being promoted may not be our idea of success.
Mm-hmm. You had a question for... We're just going to, like, make a wave, so...
Well, there was one thing that you said, Ellen, that was... that I just briefly wanted to kind of, I don't know, back up with my own experience, I guess. You were saying that, like, talking about this heartbreak that comes when you find that some authority figure in your church life isn't as trustworthy as you want them to be because you have placed so much trust in them. I definitely had that experience in terms of, like, I didn't go to BYU. I went to Southern Utah University.
Good and for you.
My institute, well, maybe, I don't know, the institute in Cedar City was just, like looking back, it was just crazy and very destructive. And I think that I really did internalize that more, like internalize that pain, and it's something that I've really noticed becoming friends with more and more women who have experienced faith crises to some degree. It's that people who were really, like, highly in tune with the church during their growing up years experience that pain much more deeply and find that it's much harder to stay with the church, I think, after something goes wrong.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I think that there is that. It's like, maybe we don't have, like, a lack of respect for authority, but when our hopes are dashed in authority,
it's bad, yeah.
But I actually had a question, so that's what I was raising.
Perfect.
And it was in response to something that Jennifer brought up, but obviously anybody who wants to respond can. You were saying at the end of your part, like, if, you know, basically we need to go beyond the boundaries of Mormonism to find the things that we need, I guess, is kind of how I interpreted it, especially as you were talking about Heavenly Mother. And I kind of had that similar experience with the feminine divine and just deciding at a certain point, like, well, the church can offer me more information about her or a connection with her or not, but either way, I need it. So if it's not here, then I'm just going to go find it someplace else. And I wonder if you guys think that the church, either the church culture or the church leadership, has the capacity to kind of, like, accept the whole, like, going somewhere else to find some things and still stay a part of the church? Or is the rhetoric just going to get more and more entrenched into where it's, like, it's all LDS or nothing, you know, or it's, you know, like, we have everything that you need and don't question that. Like, how, I guess, how do you see that working out over the years, if you have any sort of, you know, premonition about that?
With the multiplicity of ideas and religions out there, I'd say the second, because of the retrenchment mode, I think, the reactionary sort of thing. But that's just, I don't know. That's just my immediate reaction,
yeah.
So I have to think about it more.
I would have to agree. I would say, like, even with Sunday school lessons and Relief Society lessons, how they're like, stick to the manual, don't use outside. But, like, I always use outside sources, and everybody loved it.
Yeah,
but it's, you kind of see that. I'm not saying that, like, that's don't use outside sources is a reflection of what's going to happen, but it's definitely kind of an attitude that I'm, like Jennifer was saying, you know, is there. So.
I actually disagree. I think that largely, first of all, if you make adjustments to your own spiritual life individually and don't talk a ton about it, then your freedom is limitless.
Right.
You can do whatever you want.
Right, sure.
So that's good. But second, a lot of work dynamics that happen locally. I mean, your actual experience of the church is just your ward. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that depends on if you happen to live in a good area, you know, or if your priesthood leaders are really nice. Mine happen to be.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I feel like, for instance, I'll raise my hand all the time in my Sunday school in a singles ward, and the fact that it's a singles ward might have a lot to do with it. I mean, there isn't this sort of authority figure in the room, you know, monitoring me. Like, sometimes they send one, you know, because I'm there. But you know, most of the time there's not. And there's a lot of freedom. I mean, people discuss what they want to. So you can modify, you can tweak Mormonism to suit your needs. Yes, I have. I think it works pretty well.
That was my comment. The whole time I'm thinking, I've always had this, it's a difficult dilemma with me, that word church. Like, for me personally, the church is one thing, and the gospel is another thing. The gospel is my interpretation of literally sitting down in a personal prayer and talking to God and, you know, relating with Jesus or my Heavenly Mother or whatever, and that feeling of, yeah, this would be okay, and they want me to do this, and I feel good about this. The church is just a lot of imperfect people, which we all are. It's comprised of so much diversity and so many personal experiences and so much upbringing and raising, and so where are you going to go that you find a church that's for you,
mm-hmm.
In every aspect that fulfills everything? It's not going to happen. I mean, in this church or any other, it's not even possible. And so we have to adapt to some extent anywhere we go, don't we?
Yeah.
And I think the general authorities, and I think we in the church, we're all trying to do that, you know, bring some unity and comfort and, you know, help people. And but we all have different ideas of how that should be done. And,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm sad that a lot of people just write it off and go, nah, that's not for me, because they heard one thing in one meeting, got offended by one bishop or one, you know, where give it a chance, or just say, well, that's their opinion. I have lots of gay friends that I love dearly. I truly believe that Jesus loves them too, and God loves them too, and I'm not going to walk away because of that. And so then my other thought is, you've talked, do you guys feel that, I know in my experience, because I'm getting old now, and, you know, when you're 18, you have all these ideas, and you have opinions about everything on the planet, and you're, you know, dismiss that, and this is BS, and I'm not doing this. And as you get older, and you go through experiences and raising your own children, you start to see some wisdom in some of those things that were said. And you, at least me, I wished I could go back and go, I should count my mouth shut, because there was some great wisdom in what somebody was trying to tell me. Not that there aren't problems. There's problems everywhere, and I agree with so many of them that you brought up today. But do you see maybe down the road that you'll see some wisdom in some of the things that maybe you don't know or that don't work for you now, but maybe later you'll see maybe some wisdom in some of those things?
Go for it.
I'm older than this guy. But they're cooler, so.
We don't have feathers in our ears.
Oh, geez.
So
okay,
sweet.
Thanks. I'm dating myself, is why I'm laughing. But
you know, I have a lot of questions about the church, but I have children, and I do see that a structure that gives them stability, as well as a place to discuss values and morals, as well as a place to discuss things like individual worth, is valuable, and so that's definitely been an important factor in how I make decisions for them.
And do you think you would ever be able to guide them to something more perfect, or wouldn't those same issues and I don't like what so-and-so said because there's all kinds of strange things that happen everywhere and you have to fix them, you know, teachers and, you know,
sure,
at school and in life. And
I think you're right that there, I can't imagine a different church that would be, I shouldn't say I, that would be better, because maybe I can. I don't know. I don't know what, I guess what I do with it is when, is I try to offer also alternate points of view that I believe
exactly
in.
But
and
you have
I,
to do that no matter what.
Right, I try to have discussions with them about other things that are important that they won't hear.
Exactly.
Yeah, probably the thing I resonated the most with what you said is this idea of, like, you know, you're a finite person. I mean, all of these fantastic ideas that you have that you think you can just implement at the snap of a finger, and then just, like, all the world socially would be perfectly organized, and you would just be able to sit back and, you know, appreciate the Zion that you just built, you know? I just say, like, don't take it so seriously. I used to take it really, really, really seriously, and that was the problem. So if you kind of just, you know,
and that's true, too, that it's kind of within us. I have found that some of the issues that I have had with the church aren't really with the church. Like I say, I hate that word, because what is that? What is the church? Like, isn't it a bunch of ideas and plans, and somebody can read scripture and, you know, decipher it this way, and somebody else went. So I think that's really complicated. But I think if you change inside and you say, I'm okay with who I am and I can accept this, I love this about the gospel, this not so much, and, you know, I think we all have to do that to stay anywhere, not just in our religion, but in life, in our businesses, in our lives. You have to adapt, and you have to pick up the good and, you know, try to balance out what doesn't fit, and that's just kind of life.
I'd agree with that as far as a personal philosophy. You don't want to let the church off the hook entirely. I mean, it is it's an organization, it's a group of people, they make decisions. Yeah.
Well, the danger is that if you never come to that reality that, you know, I don't, there are many, many, many that, you know, and me one of them, just late in my life, if I discovered this early, it's like you just believe everything and you hate yourself for the things you're doing wrong and you feel guilty and, you know, you let all of that evil, and then that does need to change.
Well,
so,
frankly, I left because I didn't want my kids to go through what I had to go to.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
the guilt and the all these.
I feel dishonest.
Do this.
There's enough gender inequality in the
we
world.
We have some
so
more questions. So,
more
I think in our generation, speaking of us, like, kind of back to what he was saying, like, we're kind of trying to find our own voice and question the traditions of our fathers and the authority and everything. But I think where the real identity crisis comes in is where, I mean, information is so accessible. We're in the information age. Once we start learning the flaws in the history of the church and the gospel and how it's changed over time, we have that crisis. And also we see how the fundamentalists, not only in Mormonism in our cohorts, but in other religions, how it can be dangerous too, and how when people are so dependent and so complacent in a religion, pretending they know the answer to things that we really don't, it causes you to, you can kill in the name of God. You'll do anything for it. And so I think, you know, what I'm gathering from you guys, the panelists, is that you're more moderate now. Some of you aren't involved with the church, but the church is always going to be a part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this constant seeking, trying to seek more knowledge and more knowledge, it can have a tendency to propel you away from the church. And would you say, like, to the panelists, in your opinion, do your cohorts, your friends who are more fundamentalist Mormon, who are extremists and live all the commandments and do the best they can so that they can get as many smiley faces on God's chalkboard as possible so they can receive exaltation. Do you suppose that can be dangerous in the long run?
I'll field this one. I hear a lot of notes of what I call kind of a sort of new atheist critique of religion. I don't know if that's where you're drawing from or anything, but I tend to talk about this a lot.
Not necessarily atheist, but just not subjective, I guess.
Okay,
maybe
well,
as objective as possible.
So we might want to talk about this more after the panel, but I actually don't see anything wrong with the fundamentalist Mormon, I guess from a cynical view, trying to put as many smiley faces on God's chalkboard or whatever. He has a set of metaphysical beliefs. I mean, he internalizes them. For him, they're axiomatic, or they're just like fundamental to his view of the universe. And I'm not really personally afraid of him like blowing up an abortion clinic or any of the other sort of monsters of religious fundamentalism. I'm just not really that worried. I think for a lot of people, fundamentalism or any religious belief tends to be sort of a mirror. They use kind of the symbols and the stories of their religion to sort of project their inner moral inclinations onto the world. Like, I don't think it's as simple as there being some sort of a animus of religious fundamentalism that makes you go do terrible things or live a terrible life.
And I also think, kind of responding to both of you, I'm no longer active, but the church will always be an important part of my life. I'm not completely writing it off. There are lots of things I do value. Like, I went on the Mormon chapel tour yesterday, and I loved it, because it's my heritage, and my parents are converts, and they're still active. I live in Provo, It's like, but I do feel, kind of what I was talking about with the internet as well, it's a hybrid of people and technology, and I sort of feel like that a lot of people our age are kind of going towards kind of a hybrid of a lot of things. So I have no problem with, true believing, smiley face Mormons, and I have no problem with atheists. And it's more, for me, it's more like, leave me alone, let me do what I want to do. I'll kind of combine, Mormonism and all these Buddhism and, whatever. But I feel like maybe this is our generation. We have this, we're very open to everyone kind of doing what they want. And so if you want to be a fundamentalist Mormon, great. Like, but don't be in your face. Don't be in my face about it. So I don't know.
The issue I have with it is when they want to limit the discussion in Sunday school to the book. I have no problem with them believing the way they want to, but when they try to illegitimize my way of believing, maybe you guys have less trouble with that. Maybe it's okay.
No, I agree.
Uh-huh. I mean, I told you, Kim, you're the honorary millennial, so...
if the book was more interesting, I wouldn't have a problem.
Wow. No, it's true. It's kind of true. I'm really... I'm going to get all psychology jargon on you, but... my orientation in studying psychology is a really strong belief in self-determination, that I should have the right to self-determine what I want for myself, and in that I respect your right to self-determine, and I think that is missing. I think I don't mean fundamentalist Mormonism as in the sect, but...
TBMs.
Yeah, I was going to say TBMs.
Yeah, we all know what that means.
Believing Mormons... they say, do not question my right to practice Mormonism and don't ask me any questions, but you should also follow these same rules as me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that I find incongruent.
It's easy to ignore them.
Mm-hmm. And I do...
That's where you live.
That's what I do.
And this is kind of more an abstract thought. It's like, because we, Kim talked about, we have blogs and we do our own publishing and, we have this very strong desire to be authentic to our own selves. We have this very strong desire to be authentic. And I'm sure this is true for other generations, but it's, intensified in this technology generation, that when, someone, comes up to me and tells me all these things on how I need to be and how I need to live, I'm like, are you being authentic or are you just, repeating what somebody else told you? And I feel like maybe that unauthenticity of it is, for me at least, is very... I don't like it. And I don't know if anyone can... That was my personal thought, but...
Yeah.
I agree completely. Like, we're very into the whole be true unto yourself thing, and that's why I personally have an issue with change yourself instead of changing the system mentality, because I think that denotes complicity with the system, and I think that's terrible. If you don't like the system, you know, why should you comply?
All right, well, it is 6 o'clock. Have a happy dinner. Thank you for coming.